Welcome to Walnut Wednesday on this edition of the My Daily Ag Life News Report podcast. Before we start off with our Walnut Wednesday report, I want to talk about some changes to some upcoming shows. Pecan Day will be held April 6th at Yuba City, California. The California Walnut Conference will be on April 7th and April 8th in Yuba City, California as well. And the North Valley Nut Conference will be on June 8th in Orland, California. Taylor Chalstrom will start off the show with a walnut report right after this.
Soil fumigation is a critical step to ensure that your orchard gets off to a good start. Trichlor is a pre-plant soil fumigant and is the foundation for a successful pest management system. Targeted pathogens include soil-borne disease and nematodes. Fumigation helps to create a healthy soil environment that allows the plant's root system to flourish. For more information about Trichlor or to schedule an application, contact Trical Incorporated at 669-327-5076 or visit www.trical.com.
A tree's rootstock is the trunk or root in which xylem material is inserted. When looking at a walnut orchard, UCCE's Elizabeth Fichtner said you have to be aware that you're seeing two genotypes, the rootstock at the bottom of the tree and the scion that is giving rise to the actual crop. There are multiple reasons to use a rootstock on walnut trees, including disease or pest tolerance, horticultural properties like vigor or yield, and adaptability to soil and water quality. One thing Fichtner noted during the UCCE Virtual Walnut Series specifically was the difference between seedling rootstocks and clonal rootstocks, with the main ones being the general heterogeneity of the rootstocks and micropropagation.
And that is the practice of rapidly multiplying stock plant material to produce a large number of progeny plants using tissue culture. So one of the benefits of clones over seedlings is that you can grow a lot of plants very quickly. So it just allows for rapid propagation. They use a proliferation of axillary buds. And the reason they use actually already formed buds is that there's a lower mutation risk than using an adventitious bud system. So you can get approximately 5-time proliferation of these rootstocks per month. And doing more apparently would cause higher risk of epigenetic variation. So what are these axillary buds? They're actually the buds that are in the nodes along the stem. So these buds are already formed and they're just excised and put into tissue culture.
One thing that can be confusing, Fichtner noted, is that micropropagation is a form of vegetative propagation, which means that you'll have a clonal population.
When we use the term clone in walnut, we're referring to these micropropagated plants. When we talk about clones in pistachio, we're also talking about micropropagated plants. Then it gets a little confusing because when we look at the almond system, we have the micropropagated clones, but there are rootstocks that are also propagated from cuttings, vegetative cuttings. They are technically also clones. And so I just wanted to let you guys know that, you know, the terminology can be a little bit confusing depending on what cropping system you're working with. So in the walnut system, when we talk about clones, we are talking about those micropropagated plants that are produced in tissue culture.
She said not all paradox rootstocks have the same parents.
Within the commercially available paradox rootstocks, we have VX211 and Vlach, which are the result of a cross between Juglans heinzii and Juglans regia. So Northern California black and English walnut. So VX211 and Vlach are selections from that seedling population. RX1, which many of you have heard about, is slightly different. It's still a paradox. However, the female parent is Juglans microcarp. That's known as little walnut or Texas walnut. There's several names for it. I got this photo from John Priest, the Juglans microcarp. It's a small tree, and it's in the USDA germplasm collection in Winters. And I'm going to speak a little bit more about this microcarpa in future slides. So we have these three different clonal walnut rootstocks that are readily available in the commercial nursery trade. RX1, that has the microcarpa heritage, Blatch and VX211. And these are these have the Northern California Black parentage. These three rootstocks were the outcome of the Paradox diversity studies.
Fichtner also explained how these rootstocks are advertised to the public, saying that there's three separate ways.
When you purchase the rootstocks, the clones, in a containerized system, they're advertised as having great defense against crown gall. And I wanted to kind of elaborate on why this is. So why are the clonal rootstocks associated with lower incidence of crown gall, particularly when you're buying them in these containerized pots? So I want you to understand that all three of these commercial rootstocks are susceptible to crown gall. In this photograph, you can see a picture of Vlach. The reason they can be advertised as giving you some protection from agrobacterium is because of the way they are grown. They're grown in sterile systems in the test tube, and then they're grown in soilless potting medium that has been sterilized, you know, steamed twice before it's used. So they're grown in such a situation to keep them clean and keep the pathogen out. It's not that the plants themselves are resistant. So why is it different than using a seedling system? Well, what I'd like to explain is that when you use a seedling system, you can have exposure to the pathogen. When the seeds, Paradox seeds, are collected, if they hit the soil, the pathogen can be in soil. Then when those seedlings are germinated in the nursery, they can end up with crown gall on the seedlings. Also, even if you put clean seeds in the nursery, if that nursery soil had agrobacterium in it, you could end up with crown gall. Or sometimes you'll even have a gall that forms at the graft union, and that could be even from a dirty tool.
Fichtner made note of some of the characteristics of available clonal Paradox walnut rootstocks based on available data thus far, noting for Vlach, VX211, and RX1. Vlach has a vigorous rootstock, VX211 has a highly vigorous rootstock, and RX1 has a moderately vigorous rootstock. In terms of resistance to Phytophthora citricola, Vlach has a low resistance, VX211 has moderate resistance, and RX1 has moderate to high resistance. In terms of resistance to Phytophthora cinnamomi, Vlach has a low resistance, VX211 has a low resistance, and RX1 has a high resistance. And in terms of resistance to Agrobacterium tumefaciens, Vlach has a low resistance, VX211 also has low resistance, and RX1 has moderate to low resistance. Fichtner said researchers are now multiple years into the second generation of walnut rootstock trials.
They're in multiple locations throughout the state, and we've included some of these new options, like K3, for example, is just micro-carpet on its own. And I've added in this chart the reasons why we're interested. As I mentioned on the prior slide, we're interested in microcarpa in terms of its potential for mitigating crown gall by top threats.
UCCE's Greg Brown continued the presentation, explaining how these second-generation rootstocks are being researched for disease resistance in orchards.
One of the rootstock trials, this one coordinated by Catherine Jarvis Sheen up at UC Davis, involved several of our pathologists. Dan Klupfel and I shared this experiment in assessments of resistance to crown gall and Phytophthora. And the trial was planted in 2016. We included rootstock standards that Elizabeth mentioned, Vlach, RX1, and VX211. The first and the last ones, of course, are Paradox involving Northern California Black as a maternal parent. And then this RX1 is the one that Elizabeth highlighted as having microcarpa as the Black parent. And then we included four experimental rootstocks that came up through this pathway that I'll tell you more about next. A year after this trial was planted, we inoculated, in Dan Klupfel's case, with Agrobacterium tumefaciens or on separate trees. My lab infested the plots near the root crowns, but we infested the soil around the root crowns with two Phytophthora species, Phytophthora cinnamomi and Phytophthora citricola. And then just this last fall, we concluded that experiment with a backhoe and examined the root systems carefully. And here's what we found with respect to Phytophthora. Without infesting the soil and the control, no crown rot occurred that would be what Phytophthora would cause. And then in the Phytophthora inoculated plots, our susceptible standard, well, semi-susceptible standard blatch, 90% of the trees showed Phytophthora crown rot. RX1, none of the trees did show any crown rot. BX211, 76%. And then among the four experimental rootstock clones that we were testing, 0 to 76%. So one of them had zero, and the other three had some levels of crown rot, one of them pretty high, the 76. Then these are symptoms you see in the tree trunks, lower part of the Phytophthora crown rot. The last one is RX1. We saw no crown rot on it. And then we conducted isolations to make sure what we thought was infection by Phytophthora was in fact was. And it was turned out to be Phytophthora cinnamomi that was causing the damage.
Brown traced the pathway of these rootstocks and explained how they got those clonal rootstocks in the first place.
Basically, our system starts with the germplasm. And we've started with this germplasm, working with the Walnut Improvement Program and others. The knowledge is there to do the cross-pollinations needed, the hybridizations. And then through lots of teamwork, we do what we call the phenotyping, selecting for resistance. And we get these candidate root stocks. So that's the basic system. And I will illustrate this system for Phytophthora further by kind of charting the path for RX1, the Microcarpa-Viregia hybrid that we have for resistance to Phytophthora available now. We started with screening in the greenhouse with Phytophthora citricola and cinnamomi, and we identified seedlings that had resistance, retested them as clones in the greenhouse. And then once we thought we had something good, we still were uncertain because the greenhouse is certainly not the orchard. So with Farm Advisor Joe Grant, we kind of went the next step. Joe had identified an orchard where we found Phytophthora cinnamomi present and really causing lots of damage. What Joe Grant did, he planted RX1 next to a standard Paradox seedling tree at each of the sites where trees had been removed. These were pre-plant fumigated before the tree planting, but with methyl bromide, just spot treated. And so all we would get there is a slight delay in Phytophthora reinfestation. And then as the years went on, what we observed is that trees on Paradox seedling, even though they got started initially, they gradually started dying out to the point where we had lost over 40% of the trees by about 2012.
Brown finished off with some concluding thoughts for consideration on Phytophthora. In terms of best management of Phytophthora, it requires rootstocks with good genetic resistance, careful soil and water management, which would include irrigation systems being designed to avoid wetting root crowns, sanitation, and in some cases, chemical control. In terms of a reliable diagnosis of Phytophthora crown and root rot, it would require consistent symptoms typical of those caused by Phytophthora and species-specific laboratory diagnostics.
This segment was sponsored by the California Walnut Board.
Regional and national news coming your way right after this.
The Musco Family Olive Company is leading the transformation of the table olive industry. We are committed to the California olive grower and invite you to grow with our family. Modern table olive orchards apply newly perfected state-of-the-art planting and harvesting to one of the world's oldest tree crops for proven superior results. There is opportunity in any crop transition, and Musco is proud to offer long-term contracts and free trees to our grower partners. Visit us at the Agro Malora booth at the upcoming Calusa Farm Show and the World Ag Expo. See you there.
In regional news, according to winebusiness.com, they report that consumers were in the mood to spend this holiday season, with retail sales soaring 8.5% above last year. Online sales were up 11%, and in-store sales were up 8.1% between November 1st and Christmas Eve. According to the University of Connecticut, between wildfires, drought, a trade war, and a COVID-19 pandemic, the last few years have been hard on California farmers. But recent research by agricultural economists from UC Davis and the University of Connecticut suggests that economic losses to California agriculture from recent supply chain disruptions may have an even greater economic impact. Their models estimate that there was a 17% decline in the value of containerized agricultural exports between May and September of 2021. Resulting from recent port congestion. According to the authors of the study, including Sandro Steinbach, assistant professor in the College of Agriculture, Health and Natural Resources, this amounts to around $2.1 billion in lost foreign sales, which exceeds losses from the 2018 U.S.-China trade war. Increased U.S. demand for imported goods from Asia also led to increased demand for empty shipping containers in Asia. Prior to the pandemic, freight rates for shipping containers from Shanghai to Los Angeles were already higher than the return trip from Los Angeles, but this gap widened significantly after COVID-19. By September of 2021, the fee to ship a 40-foot container from Shanghai to Los Angeles had increased sixfold to $12,000, while the return trip from Los Angeles was only $1,400. The high prices for containers from Asia, coupled with shipping delays from the high volume of imported goods entering California ports, made it more profitable for shippers to return containers to Asia empty rather than waiting at the ports to have them loaded with U.S. exports for the return trip. University of Connecticut's Department of Agriculture and Resource Economics calculated that by September of 2021, nearly 80% of all containers leaving California ports were empty, about 43% fewer filled containers leaving California ports than there were prior to the pandemic. The Department of Water Resources conducted the first snow survey of the season at Phillips Station. Early winter storms this month provided a strong start to the season and some drought relief, but California remains in a drought. The recent manual survey recorded 78.5 inches of snow depth and a snow water equivalent of 20 inches, which is 202% of average for this location at this time of the year. The snow water equivalent measures the amount of water contained in the snowpack and is a key component of DWR's water supply forecast. Statewide, the snowpack is at 160% of average for this time of the year. December is the first of three typically wettest months of California's water year. Significant January and February precipitation would be required to generate enough runoff to make up for the previous two winters that were California's fifth and second driest water years on record. California has experienced wet Decembers before, only to have storms disappear for the remainder of the season. In 2013, the first snow survey provided promising results after a wet December, similar to this year. However, the following January and February were exceptionally dry, and the year ended as the driest on record, contributing to a record-breaking drought. On average, the Sierra snowpack supplies about 30% of California's water needs, and the snowpack is an important factor in determining how DWR manages the state's water resources. National agricultural news right after this break.
Soil and Crop Incorporated is your number one resource for sustainable nutrition. Growers are faced with difficult challenges, and Soil and Crop Inc. has the experience, fertilizer, and biological portfolio to dramatically increase yield and performance in your troubled orchards and fields.
Contact Soil and Crop Incorporated today for a free consultation on how we can help reverse the challenges you face as a conventional or organic grower so you can increase your bottom line and become a better sustainable farmer. Contact us today at 559-564-1236 or visit our website at www.callnrg.com. Soil and Crop, putting nature to work for you.
Political reports, the White House and the Environmental Protection Agency are targeting February for the administration's Waters of the U.S. debut. WOTUS continues its seesaw reputation since first announced during the Obama administration. The Trump administration overhauled the rule, and now the Biden administration is doing the same. The Environmental Protection Agency moved last month to formally remove the Trump-era rule known as the Navigable Waters Protection Rule. However, the rule has not been in use since a federal judge in Arizona threw it out at the end of August. The American Farm Bureau Federation says that the Trump-era rule protects water resources, respects the law, and provides greater clarity so the agency's farmers and the public can identify regulated federal waterways. EPA Administrator Michael Reagan said he sees flaws in both versions of the rule and wants a durable definition. The comment period for the new rule closes February 7th of 2022. The U.S. Department of Agriculture has announced loan interest rates for January of 2022, which were effective as of January 3rd. USDA's farms... The U.S. Department of Agriculture announced loan interest rates for January of 2022, which were effective as of January 3rd. USDA's Farm Service Agency loans provide important access to capital to help agricultural producers start or expand their farming operation, purchase equipment and storage structures, or meet cash flows. Here are the interest rates for operating and ownership loans for January of 2022. Farm operating loans direct at 2.125%, farm ownership loans direct at 3%, farm ownership loans direct joint financing at 2.50%, farm ownership loans with a down payment at 1.50%, and emergency loans, amount of actual loss at 3.125%. FSA also offers guaranteed loans through commercial lenders at rates set by those lenders. And the Senate returns from the holidays with an uncertain agenda, with nominees to take up floor time while members work on leftover priorities from last year, including appropriations and the budget reconciliation package. The first vote of the year will be on whether to confirm Gabrielle Sanchez to the 9th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. Sanchez worked as senior aide to former California Governor Jerry Brown and has been less controversial than President Biden's other 9th Circuit picks. Identity preservation is the process of differentiating commodities requiring a strict separation, typically involving containerized shipping be maintained at all times. Identity preserved is often used to market commodities like food-grade corn and soybeans, but there are IP contracts for conventional, organic, and biotech seeds also. The vast majority of IP crops are grown conventionally, according to USDA. The concept of IP has been accorded greater importance with the introduction of genetically modified organisms into agriculture. For markets that have sensitivities to genetically engineered food, such as the European Union, non-GE crops are specified and grown for that market. Domestically, some food manufacturers wanting to label their products as non-GMO will also demand an IP non-GE crop to be grown and delivered, according to USDA. On December 2nd, Specialty Soya and Grains Alliance launched U.S. Identity Preserved, an advancement in food traceability. Specialty Soya and Grains Alliance is a national business association of companies focused on the production, processing, and shipping of U.S. IP field crops and their related products worldwide. With the U.S. Identity Preserved designation, they're delivering a quality assurance plan that brings together the U.S. IP industry and reinforces the United States as a quality origin for those IP crops. That according to Eric Wenberg, Executive Director of SSGA. He says U.S. Identity Preserved will help U.S. process and exporters broaden access and open more foreign markets as well as better compete in the international market. From seed to end user, IP practices will segregate crops throughout the value chain, delivering a specific quality or trait to the end market. Those practices then allow for open, transparent communication between supplier and customer, according to DTN. Stay tuned, as right after this, we'll have discussion on how carbon markets are being developed in the United States. Let your bees carry a beneficial biofungicide directly to flowers and reduce brown rot blossom blight and jacket rot. Sign up for a field trial of bee vectoring and the biofungicide Vectorite with CR7 on your almond orchard. Deadline is January 15th for setup and use at the start of your February bloom. Email contact at beevt.com. USDA reporter Rod Bain has more information now regarding sequestering carbon and developing ecological and economic markets for carbon crops.
Carbon sequestration and carbon markets. What should you know about it? A recent National Association of Farm Broadcasting panel offered their thoughts to help the public in general understand why various practices could lead to both environmental and economic gains. Land O'Lakes' Jason Weller says farmers have been at the forefront of practices that keeps carbon in the soil for centuries. Cover crops and no-till as examples.
This is not a new approach. What's different is now bringing precision agronomy, precision technology, new insights into hybrid technologies, microbiological insights, nurture and enhance the function of those living ecosystems. Now that's kind of this new frontier of science and where we can accelerate carbon sequestration and quantify that.
Chris Harbert of Indigo Ag also acknowledges increasing innovations to allow fields to remain green, covered in crops and plant life all year long.
These companies are out there trying to think of what's next to really help farmers capitalize on this opportunity. What I think we're all trying to do is then turn that into a business opportunity, turn that into a revenue. We're calling it a carbon crop. How do you bring in that carbon crop? How do you turn that into a recurring, reliable revenue stream for the farm?
That means proper crediting, monetary and ecological, through means such as carbon markets. Andrew Lentz of Ecosystem Services Market Consortium explains more companies are seeking environmental benefits.
They're sort of CSR and corporate environmental reporting disclosures and also compliance markets, water quality compliance markets as well.
Opening the door for new businesses to quantify eco-benefits, such as carbon sequestration created by agricultural practices.
To sort of stack these environmental benefits into credits as we see the demand for these types of environmental outcomes rising, both at the corporate level but also in compliance markets as well.
Panelists, however, agree that these credits have no value unless businesses and investors demand them. And while interest and support have been growing for carbon offsets by businesses, Weller says,
yes, there's definitely strong farmer interest in it, but making it actually feasible and economically successful for farmers, that's going to be the hardest thing to do.
I'm Rod Bain reporting for the U.S. Department of Agriculture in Washington, D.C.
USDA has released resources for biofuels producers that were impacted by COVID-19. Coming up next, we hear remarks from USDA Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack on how those funds are being distributed.
JCS Marketing is your number one way to connect with the ag industry. Through print magazines, digital media, podcasts, and live and virtual events, JCS Marketing has the reach to inform, educate, and influence growers in the Western United States.
Everywhere you go, you see West Coast Nut Magazine on every one of my customers' tables. So that tells you everything. It's there, so they're reading it.
Our My Ag Life platform includes podcast interviews and digital articles for busy professionals on the go. Our live events, continuing education webinars, and virtual conferences help growers connect with leading researchers and industry leaders. Let JCS Marketing help you connect.
U.S. Department of Agriculture Tom Vilsack talks more about how important the biofuels industry is to the Biden administration. He also talks about the $700 million that is being dedicated to biofuel producers.
The money and the resource would go to biofuel producers, or the ethanol companies and biofuel and soy diesel producers, the companies that produce the fuel, to assist and help in defraying the costs that they incurred and the challenges they had during the pandemic when transportation, when we were traveling less and therefore less gas was being purchased. And it really is designed in part to acknowledge the importance that this administration places on the biofuel industry. And I say this because it isn't just about the volume levels for the RFS, as important as they are. It's also about the stability of those volume levels. The reality is when you grant waivers, as the Trump administration did, I think over 80 waivers, it basically undercuts the stability of those volume standards and creates instability in the market. And that's one thing that I know biofuel producers across the board don't want. They want stability, number one. Number two, this is an administration that understands that we need to continually look for innovative solutions to climate, innovation solutions to lower cost fuels. And that's one of the reasons why this administration isn't going to invest $4.3 billion in a series of grants loans to create the aviation fuel industry. It is United, American Airlines, and other airlines are clamoring for a drop in aviation fuel that will allow them to comply with international standards as they fly these long-term flights, and allow them to lower costs. And the reality is to significantly reduce the environmental footprint. And we know from the experience with ethanol and the improvements that have been made and the environmental comparison between ethanol and regular gas, there is a direct environmental benefit in expanding access to biofuels, which is why we continue to invest in higher blends, while we're making the investment today, and we'll continue to make investments and infrastructure that will also expand the utilization of higher blends at the pump, and then obviously creating an opportunity for a 36 billion gallon industry of not blended fuel, but drop-in aviation fuel, which is an enormous opportunity to grow this industry. So you know, we're going to continue to look for ways to provide help and assistance and stability, and I think that's what you're going to see.
Secretary Vilsack says the $700 million will be issued in the form of grants.
We'll be announcing the framework on that very, very soon. Just to make sure, when we talk about producers, we're not talking about individual farmers. We're talking about the ethanol companies, the businesses that produce the ethanol, which obviously in turn provides assistance and help because it maintains those ethanol production facilities, which in turn are the ones who are purchasing corn from individual corn producers.
USDA Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack. And that will wrap up our show here for today. This is the My Ag Life Daily News Report. I'm Lori Boyer from the JCS Marketing Team. Thanks for listening.